Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. You might think that using the French horn as the lead instrument in an electronic band would be enough to, you know, distinguish yourself. But the guys in the band called French Horn Rebellion didn't stop there. So they show up here in the studio wearing these shirts with brightly glowing neon-type piping woven into them. Fortunately, we shot video so you can see what I'm talking about at soundcheck.org. I asked how they worked, and they told me that a friend of theirs had made the shirts.
He sewed in EL wire into the jacket, and it's operated by a battery pack in our, in our pockets.
Can you wash them?
Well, don't get too close. You might smell some stuff there.
Yeah, see, that's the sort of probing journalism that built public radio's reputation. Luckily, you don't need your nose to experience the French Horn Rebellion's live set coming up later. Also, the Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer and essayist Ira Burko of the New York Times looks back on a life as a fan of baseball and of music. And in 2 weeks, we'll all be looking back at Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, marking its 100th anniversary. Conductor Leon Botstein will give us some of the backstory of the piece. But as long as everyone's looking back, remember Simon and Paula and Randy? Remember when half of America would tune in to watch the three judges launching some singing careers and shooting down others? Remember when American Idol mattered? Okay, maybe that's one question too many. But the fact is that the juggernaut that was American Idol has slowed, and big changes are afoot. At least, that's what Jethro Nettadog is reporting. He's senior TV writer for the entertainment industry website The Wrap, and he's on the line from California. Hi, Jethro.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So last week you reported on some pretty big changes ahead for the American Idol brand, including all new judges. How did you get that information? Because no one else seems to have it.
People talk. It is Hollywood. People talk. But also we just had a really well-informed insider who felt like telling us this information.
Now, we should mention that so far only Randy Jackson has publicly confirmed that he's going to be leaving American Idol. The other judges and the producer, Nigel Lithgow, have not yet confirmed this publicly. If this is going to happen, Jethro, why is it going to happen?
Well, basically, it's going to happen because of ratings. Fox is in the business of selling advertising and delivering 20% lower viewership this season means a lot of things. It means they'll have to pay back advertisers either and make goods and all that kind of stuff, and no one wants to lose money.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it still a huge money maker at the end of the day?
Absolutely. It's still Fox's number one cash cow. It still makes the most money for the network. So, of course, they want to figure out some way to save it.
How important is it that they keep pace with NBC's The Voice? Is there a sense that they're kind of playing second fiddle to that show?
Of course there is, but it has a lot to do with just being able to keep the idea that it's the number one talent show. I mean, it still generates the most stars, but as far as viewership, and also, by the way, American Idol was replaced by The Voice last year for the Emmy race. Mm. So there's also egos involved, too. It's about being able to claim who's got the best show.
Right. We're speaking with Jethro Nettadog, the senior TV writer for The Wrap, the entertainment industry website. So there are two American Idol Season 12 finalists who are going to face off tomorrow night on Fox, and then the winner will be revealed on Thursday evening. And both finalists are women, Candace Glover, Cree Harrison. So do you smell a little engineering behind the scenes? Because the past 5 years, it's been white guys with guitars.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was definitely an eye toward females this season. You can see even in the earlier weeks that the men really didn't stack up to the females. Everyone has known that the finalists were going to be female, but they really seem to have stacked the deck toward females this season.
Mm. All right. One of the two finalists is a 23-year-old R&B singer from South Carolina. Her name is Candice Glover. Let's hear a little.
You won't find him trying to chase the day.
That is Candice Glover, one of the two finalists for this year's 12th season of American Idol, and her version of Emily Sandé's song Next to Me. The other finalist is a country singer from Texas. Her name is Cree Harrison.
Here comes goodbye. Here comes the last time. Here comes the start of every sleepless night. The first of every tear I comes me wishing things had never changed. If he was right here in my arms tonight. But here comes goodbye.
That is Cree Harrison, and Here Comes Goodbye, her cover of a Rascal Flatts song. So either she or Candice will be the next American Idol. We're speaking with Jethro Nettadog, who has written about possible changes ahead for the brand, for the entertainment industry website, The Wrap. What do you think American Idol has to do, other than a new slate of judges, to really make a comeback?
Well, I think that they do have to kind of bring the attention back to contestants. The talent, like I mentioned earlier with guys, wasn't that great. It wasn't that high a bar. And it seemed like they really need to focus on finding young, undiscovered talent that really kind of blow us away rather than sort of mediocre singers.
Yeah.
And I think that will enliven people. I think the fact that they have these theme nights they've been doing since Jesus' birth, like for 102 years, they've been doing these theme nights that maybe don't translate as well to an audience. Like, you know, I mean, not to knock Burt Bacharach, but his songs seem a little dated now. It's hard to update them. When you sing a Beatles song, it's tough to do it by yourself when it's, you know, originally it's such a masterpiece with the group.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think edging toward more modern songs, edging toward more stuff that's on the radio today. But I also think that, like, you know, American Idol is still a hit. It still brings in 11 million viewers, 12 million viewers every episode. I mean, it's still a big show in today's TV landscape.
Well, it'll be big without Randy Jackson, how big is a question, and whether Mariah Carey and Nicki Minaj and Keith Urban will be a part of it, very much an open question, although, as Jethro has written, apparently all four will be gone for next season. Season 13 of American Idol auditions begin in July, and Jethro Nettadog is senior TV writer for The Wrap, the entertainment industry website. Jethro, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
This is Soundcheck.
My old friend, I recall times we had are hanging on my wall. I wouldn't trade them for gold. They laughed and they cried me, they somehow sanctified me. They're woven in the stories I have told. Until again, my old friend.
Just about every day at 2 p.m. Eastern on soundcheck.org, we stream a live performance taking place here in the studio. Tomorrow, this artist, Sam Amidon, will be here playing songs from his new album, Bright Sunny South. All you have to do to hear it live is go to soundcheck.org and click play tomorrow at 2. Up next, Pulitzer Prize winning sports writer and essayist Ira Burko handcrafts a pick three playlist just for us. And later, it's the French horn as you've never heard it before when the dance funk band French Horn Rebellion overtakes our studio. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's no secret that here at Soundcheck, we're not just fans of music. We're also pretty big sports fans, too. And we're really interested in the way that sports and music intersect. So when we saw that the Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer and essayist Ira Burko had a new collection out, we thought it'd be a great chance to indulge in our second passion. Ira Burko is indulging us by bringing in a pick three of some of his favorite songs. His new book is called Summers at Shea: Tom Seaver Loses His Overcoat and Other Mets Stories. Ira Burko, welcome to Soundcheck.
Well, thank you, John. Good to be here.
So music and sports, they're kind of united by the idea of fandom, aren't they?
Well, they're also united by the aspect of rhythm and harmony.
Ah, good
and,
point.
You know, a team has to be, as they say, in sync.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to know where all the movable parts are. I mean, sometimes you'll see a guard come down and pass the ball to a forward who's cutting to the basket, and the ball goes into the stands.
Right.
This team is not in harmony, it's not in rhythm, and it's not in sync. On the other hand, you'll see a guy cutting to the basket, and there's that high pass, that alley-oop, but also there's cutting and there's move. This is just basketball.
Right.
Is there anything more beautiful and balletic than a great double play in baseball?
Mm-hmm.
And the rhythms, just like in a ballet with the music, and the jumping has to be right into the arms of the male, the throw from the shortstop to the second baseman has to be chest high for him to be able to turn and throw to first base and to get the runner at first.
And the throw has to be made before the second baseman is in the area.
Is right, yeah. Right. But if it's a throw at the ankles, you're not going to get the double play.
Right.
Similarly, and I'll use basketball again, guard comes down, the forward is there, the forward fakes to go to the basket, comes back, and gets the pass. If the pass is around his ankles and not in shooting rhythm, he's going to have a tough time bringing the ball up. The defensive guy is going to be there. The ball has to be chest high, and it can't be head high because he can't bring the ball down. So all of this is rhythm, it's harmony. And what's more beautiful, what's more harmonious than that?
Well, you know, and
I'm asking you, John.
Well, I would say equally as beautiful and harmonious mm-hmm. is a band that is tight. You know, when we say an ensemble is tight, you mm-hmm. know, it's the same thing where everybody is sort of anticipating at the same time so that when that pass is made, you're not buying your teammate's fake. You're going to where he actually is going to be. And so
right.
he arrives, you arrive, the ball arrives, he arrives, right height. That's right. That's like a band.
And there's practice. But there's a sense of the moment of what guys are going to do and have confidence in your teammates and what's going to happen. And a perfect example in music for me is one of my all-time favorite concerts, one of my all-time favorite songs is the 1938 Carnegie Hall, Benny Goodman, Sing, Sing, Sing.
Spirituals to Swing was it was released on an album under that title.
Yeah, but it was Sing, Sing, Sing. It goes on for about 25 minutes. Gene yeah. Krupa, Harry James, Lionel Hampton, Benny Goodman, and it was all improvisational. And each one knew at some moments, okay, I take over now. And so to me, it was like watching this, you know, a great double play.
Uh-huh.
They all knew where they were supposed to be, and they hit the right notes.
They all hit the cutoff man.
They all hit the cutoff man.
Ira Burko is my guest on Soundcheck, the Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer. His new book is called Summers at Shea, Tom Seaver Loses His Overcoat and Other Mets Stories. It's hard to talk about music and sports or music and baseball without thinking back to Take Me Out to the Ball Game, you know, which has been... Now, you're from Chicago.
I am.
Where that's an especially long and strong tradition, right?
Well, it is. And especially when Harry Carey was the Cubs announcer in the 80s, 90s. And here he was a great, great character. And, of course, Wrigley Field is an iconic ballpark. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing like Wrigley Field. I think it was the only ballpark ever that was a subject for Architectural Digest. I mean, it's a particularly gorgeous field. Mm-hmm. And Harry Carey used to hang out at the seventh inning, would hang out of the broadcast booth with his microphone, and he would sort of sway, singing, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Invariably, the Cubs, no matter where they're at, and usually in last place as they are right now, would sell out close to 40,000 fans invariably at that ballpark.
All of whom should have been in school or at work.
Yeah, right. But the ones who were supposed to be at work were all attending their grandmother's funeral.
Right.
Because
we're talking about day games for the
right,
most part.
Right, mostly day games. But when Harry Carey would lean out of that broadcast booth and start singing and swaying himself, 40,000 people would turn toward the broadcast booth and begin to sway with him singing, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. It was some kind of like a church epiphany. It was a really remarkable moment in sports.
And sort of become such a cliche that we forget what a great old song this was.
Yeah.
And an early example of almost like a proto-feminist song, because the person singing it is a woman in the original song.
Uh-huh. Katie.
Katie, right.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Edward Meeker's recording from 1908, the year that the song was written by Jack Norworth and Albert von Tilzer, sort of the unofficial anthem of baseball.
Katie, Katie was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad. Just to root for the hometown crew, every Sioux, Katie Blue. On a Saturday, her young beau called to see if she'd like to go to see a show. But Miss Kate said, no, I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
That is Edward Meeker, recorded in 1908, the year that the song Take Me Out to the Ball Game was written. And still sung in ballparks across this land of ours. Ira Burko is with me on Soundcheck.
1908 has a certain resonance for a Cubs fan.
Yep.
Because 1908 was the last year the Cubs won a World Series. They're now at 105 years since they've, they've won a World Series.
Now, so when we refer to long-suffering Mets fans, for example, they don't know about long-suffering.
It's a joke.
Now, your book is kind of a it's not just about the Mets. It's really about Shea Stadium, which, you know, was not a beloved place.
Well, it's about the ball games and the ball players who played in Shea,
yeah.
And it's also not just about the Mets players. It's about some of their rivals, you know, who Bob Gibson and all through the years, who played Henry Aaron, who played at in Shea Stadium and played against the Mets. And so it's a collection of my columns over a period of some 40 years, writing primarily for the New York Times.
Right. You write that the Mets have been disappointing in the field this year and have not been consistent. But you've been writing something like that for about 40 years about the Mets. So they have sort of been consistent.
Well, they've had some good years. You know, I mean, 1969, and they won the World Series. They came out of nowhere. The previous nine seasons, this is their 10th season, I think, was maybe 8th or 9th or 10th, I forget, in the major leagues. And for all those previous seasons, they were either 9th or 10th. And then suddenly the Amazons come out, you know, and they beat the Cubs to go get into the World Series.
Right, right.
And then there was the great 86 series in which they were behind to the Red Sox, and Buckner has a ball go through his legs. Then there was the City Series, essentially.
The Subway Series, yeah.
The Subway Series in 2000.
Yeah. Great moment for, for us Yankees.
And then there was, and also, let's not forget, Yogi Berra's 1973 Mets. Mm-hmm. They played Oakland in the World Series.
Despite barely having a record above 500 that year, as
yeah,
I recall.
Right. But that was Yogi. Yogi Berra. Yogi Berra. Yeah. He walked around with a star on him somehow.
Now, you write, we started by talking about, the commonality of fandom between music and sports. You write that loyalty of this sort, and you're talking about sports now, begins with youthful enchantment, which is something we've talked about on this show. Normally the music that stays with you for the rest of your life is the music you fall in love with when you're like 13, 14, 15. You're beginning to figure out who you are and stuff like that.
Well, I grew up in the 50s. I was a teenager in the 50s. I was a teenager from 1953 to 1959. So those are the mm-hmm. 50s. And I loved all those rock and roll songs. I grew up with the rock and roll songs. And I used to work on a street in Chicago. It was an old world marketplace. I started when I was 11 years old selling stockings. And it was black, it was Puerto Rican, Hispanic, it was Jewish, it was a mixture of things. But I remember going into a bar in the early 50s and hearing a song that I just adored. And it was Hound Dog by Big Mama Thornton.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
And so now this is like 52, 53. And then a couple of years later, Elvis Presley comes out with a big hit. It was Hound Dog. Well, Hound Dog was a beloved song for me, but it was Big Mama Thornton's song.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
So you were already a music snob as a teenager?
Yeah,
one of those people
yeah.
who go, "Oh, I like the original, but not this Elvis kid."
Well, not only did I like the original, it was the only singer that I knew. And so here comes Elvis, and Elvis was good, but he wasn't Big Mama Thornton. But then, Chuck Berry and Little Richard.
You had told once the Sports Business Daily back in 2007, you said, "I always said if I were a groupie, I would follow Little Richard to the ends of the earth."
And I still hold to that.
Although you then added, Chopin was pretty good too.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you don't go that far back that you've seen Chopin. But Little Richard, talk about showmanship.
Oh, I love Little Richard.
This guy was the Ricky Henderson of music.
Oh, yeah. The Ty Cobb and the Joe DiMaggio. And boy, could he perform. And it was about 6-7 years ago. He came to New York, and I had to see him. And my wife wasn't interested. And I said, "You have to go to see Little Richard with me." He was playing on 22nd Street. I forgot the name of the club. And so she goes, and Little Richard now is in. It's an hour into when he was supposed to be showing up, and he wasn't showing up. And it's now 2 hours we're sitting there, and they have all these other bands coming, all these other people singing. I think people from the audience were, and then the MC says, "Little Richard is in the house." Oh, my God, he's in the house. Well, anyway, he showed up all spangled, and he starts playing, and Long Tall Sally and Tutti Frutti, and we were just jumping out of our seats. My wife couldn't contain herself, and it was one of the great nights, and she said it was worth it to wait 2 hours for Little Richard.
Tutti Frutti, oh, Rudy.
That is Tutti Frutti from Little Richard, and it's good to see that Ira Burko, the Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer and essayist, still enjoys that song, bopping around here in the soundcheck studio.
I can give you the first couple of lines to Long Tall Sally, if you're interested.
Lay it on me.
Long Tall Sally, saw Mary coming, jump back in the alley, oh baby, woo! Gonna have some fun tonight.
So you can really go up and hit those high notes. Did you ever play music yourself?
In high school, I took a band class and I played the trumpet. And the professor, the only music teacher, the only band teacher we had in this high school in Chicago, Sullivan High School, and he wanted me to play in the band. I took it just as a course, a minor, and then he thought I was good enough to play in the band. It was a horrible band, but anyway, I was on the basketball team and on the baseball team, and I just felt that it was inappropriate for a so-called athlete to also be in the band. So that ended my career as a as a musician.
So that was not good for your cool factor in school?
Yeah.
In the band.
I thought the girls would be more interested in a basketball player than a trumpet player. But I was probably wrong about that. I might have had more success as a trumpet player.
Sounds like there's another book in there somewhere. Ira Burko's latest book is Summers at Shea, Tom Seaver Loses His Overcoat and Other Mets Stories. Your last collection was about the Yankees. So are you a man of divided loyalty? Loyalties or no loyalty to either?
No, my loyalty is to the story, really. But, you know, in New York, I was a columnist for the New York Times for 26 years. Before that, for a Scripps Howard Syndicate Newspaper Enterprise Association. So you wrote about the teams, you know, that you were closest to and you could get to by subway.
Mm-hmm.
I really was more interested in being a writer and a storyteller, but also dealing with issues and commentary.
Mm-hmm.
I did that, and you may or may not be interested that in September I have a collection of my Knicks columns, but they're really sort of basketball columns, and it's called Autumn's in the Garden.
All right. So that'll be coming out in September.
Before
we wrap up, let's wrap up with Patsy Cline's recording of Tennessee Waltz. You've told us some pretty interesting stories about some of these other songs that mean something to you. What's the story behind this 1946 classic?
Well, I saw a one-woman play about 5 or 6 years ago on Patsy Cline. It was down in the Village. And the singer sang Tennessee Waltz. Tennessee Waltz has always been one of my favorite songs. And I remember growing up, it was Patti Page
right. Who
sang, and it was a popular song. And then I was influenced by this one-woman play to go to YouTube and to hear Patsy Cline actually sing it, not an actress. And I thought it was wonderful. And she brought heart and soul to it in a way that I thought Patti Page didn't, because she had to homogenize it, as did Elvis Presley for Hound Dog.
Mm-hmm.
So Patsy Cline had a resonance for me. That's one of my favorite songs, too.
Well, Ira Burko, the Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer and essayist, thanks for sharing some of your musical fandom with us here on Soundcheck today.
Well, thank you, John.
I introduced her to my loved one, and while they were waltzing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember that night and the Tennessee Waltz.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Yesterday on the show, we heard about the controversy, the most famous riot in musical history, the one that met Stravinsky's Rite of Spring when it premiered 100 years ago this month. The date was May 29th, 1913. We're gearing up to mark the anniversary of the piece and its impact, and we continue to look at the story now behind the Rite of Spring. On the actual anniversary, May 29th at 7 p.m., the pianist Vicky Chow will join us in the green space for a live performance of the work on solo piano. Joining us right now on the line is Leon Botstein, the music director of the American Symphony Orchestra and president of Bard College. Leon, nice to talk to you again.
Nice to be on the radio again.
So yesterday, Leonard Slatkin, the conductor, told us that he thought it was really the dance and the dancers that provoked the riot, that famous riot, rather than the music. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think that's largely right. The fact is that the music had a clearly divided reaction. There were certainly people who thought it was the sonorities were so harsh and the relentless nature of it. The quick transitions, what makes the Rite of Spring so striking is that it's not symphonically written. It's not like a theme that goes and develops and there's a lot of repetition. There are these abrupt shifts. And so it is, it certainly took people aback, but there are also people who recognized it immediately as a work of genius. And its success as a piece of music was very quick.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really the sort of dancing and perhaps the costumes a bit. So I think the scandal was less musical than it was theatrical.
Yeah. Now, Diaghilev, the impresario behind the Ballet Russe, which produced Rite of Spring, would have been delighted with the scandal. What about Stravinsky? Where was he in his career? He's still a relatively young composer at that time, right?
It's hard to know because he said different things about it at different times in his career. His reaction in the West was eventually, of course, very positive because it made his name. He became a notorious and celebrity overnight. And despite his sayings to the contrary, it's hard to complain.
We're speaking with Leon Botstein, the music director of the American Symphony Orchestra and president of Bard College, which this summer will present Bard Music Festival's Stravinsky and His World, July 6th through August 18th. Most of the concerts are in August. And what was Stravinsky? What were Stravinsky and Diaghilev and Nijinsky? What were all these Russians doing in Paris?
Well, interestingly, so there was the world of art movement that Diaghilev was involved in, which broke with a kind of realist nationalist tradition in the 19th century. But the reaction of the Russian audiences, given the autocracy and the general conditions, was less favorable. But the real opportunity was the exoticism of this kind of self-conscious Russianism. The Parisians, like all imperialist nations, love to digest in a kind of pretentious way the exotic colors of nations on whom they looked actually down upon. So it was a kind of strange fashionability, the Japanese, the Russian, the things east.
The exotic east, yeah.
Absolutely. And so Diaghilev exploited this shamelessly. and Stravinsky was part of it. Stravinsky was a very nasty man, cheap, disloyal, anti-Semitic, an unpleasant character. He was looking for the next great thing after the great success of Petrushka. And to his credit, The Rite of Spring is a work of, you know, incomparable genius.
It's not just that. It's also, I mean, Petrushka is you know, a recognizable work of Stravinsky's early period. I mean, you see it growing out of Firebird. You know, you kind of recognize the Russian roots and what he's doing. The Rite of Spring is a quantum leap.
It's a quantum leap in the use, you're absolutely right. It's a quantum leap in the use of time. And doesn't rely on kind of sequential memory. It doesn't have a recapitulation. It doesn't bring stuff back where the beginning. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
It's a different attitude to the way one makes music. It forces you to confront the moment of time as it's happening. It's tremendously immediate. ¶¶
And the story of, you know, this kind of pagan ritual and the young girl who eventually dances herself to death to, you know, to propitiate the deities, you know, that would have played into that whole exotic Eastern thing you were talking about.
Oh, yeah, and shocking of sexual mores. You know, the pagan ritual and all of this and the elders and sacrifice and, you know, harking back to a pre-Christian old Russia. This to modern audiences, this is less, you know, we're you know, steeled against this kind of shock. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that the power of the music, the eloquence of the music, still stays with us. And the piano version, which you're using, is actually proof of how good a piece. Because many pieces that are so colorful, as the Rite of Spring is, and so dependent on the orchestra and its sounds, don't translate well to the piano, but the Rite of Spring does.
We are certainly looking forward to hearing Vicky Chow's performance, her solo piano performance of the Rite of Spring on the actual 100th anniversary of the piece, May 29th, 7 p.m. in the Green Space. For tickets, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. And Leon Botstein's Bard Music Festival this year, focusing, not surprisingly, on Stravinsky and his world in July and August up at
Bard.
And
we're doing the Rite of Spring, as well as another piece by Steinberg written for Diaghilev in the same year.
Great. Well, Leon Botstein, the music director of the American Symphony Orchestra and president of Bard College, always great to speak with you. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
A little bit of the Berlin Philharmonic's recording of The Rite of Spring. Up next, speaking of riot-causing music, French Horn Rebellion is going to cause one here in our studio when they bring their glowing shirts and strobe lights to the studio. That's next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The brothers Robert and David Perlick-Molinari are calling for a rebellion. A French horn rebellion, to be precise. The two formed their electropop band, featuring the famously challenging brass instrument, back in 2007. And since then, they've brought their dance beats to concertgoers and clubbers around the world. Today, they're here in the Soundcheck studio with us, along with the rest of the band, and they're going to kick things off with a song called This Moment. This is French Horn Rebellion, live on Soundcheck.
All right, David, are you ready to rebel? I don't know what you got.
Pull apart again.
That is French Horn Rebellion, live in the Soundcheck studio with their song This Moment. Live performance by a full band with light show and battery-operated shirts and all kinds of stuff. Robert Perlick-Molinari singing and playing the French horn, and David Perlick-Molinari doing some vocals and keyboards, Paul Hammer behind the drum kit, Dominic Magnota playing electric drums, Zach Abramson on bass, Joe Trombino and Effie Liu with backing vocals. First of all, Robert and David, thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
You were told this was radio, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we heard these two guys were going to come by. So.
Right. We've got the video. We do have video being shot. It is definitely worth checking out because there's, as I say, the lights and the dancers now. So it's like a Friday night in here, and you guys are apparently all about Friday night. The EP, in collaboration with Viceroy, is called Friday Nights. That's out now. And you're just finishing up this Friday night residency.
It's our favorite day of the week, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you say, Robert?
Well, I think so. I mean, if you were there last Friday at Brooklyn Bowl, I think I said Friday night about 10 times.
Just to remind you.
Friday night! You guys having fun! Like that.
But you start at midnight, right?
That's true.
So it's actually Saturday morning. Saturday morning! Just doesn't have the same ring to it, though, does it?
Really, does it?
Robert, you play the French horn, which is an instrument. There are a handful of jazz French hornists, but the vast majority of people who play that instrument are classical, you know, orchestral musicians.
It's true.
What are you doing in a dance band?
Well, basically, one day I was in orchestra. I used to play in the Chicago Civic Orchestra, and I went to Northwestern, and we were playing some, like, thing by Persichetti called The Body Electric.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wait a minute.
Vincent Persichetti, the American composer.
Right, he was doing the Walt Whitman poem in an orchestra setting. It was for wind ensemble. And I was like, wait a minute, The Body Electric, that'd make an awesome dance song. So then I went home and I was like, wait a minute, this is a way more fun than playing The Body Electric by, you know, Vincent Persichetti.
Yeah. So do you guys come from a classical music family?
I'd say a little bit.
Our mom encouraged it heavily.
We were definitely encouraged. So
our dad was a professional athlete, and we have three brothers. She thought that we were going to be thugs, I guess. So she made sure we had some cultural activity. Yeah.
So what kind of athlete was your dad?
He's a football player.
Who is he?
Well, he played for UVA. He's a record holder there. And then
UVA,
he went to the,
being University of Virginia,
yeah.
At
Thomas Jefferson's school,
University. Okay. Down in
okay,
yeah.
Nice. And then he went to, he's not a famous football player,
he's
but,
not famous,
but he went to a Canadian professional league. He played for the Argonauts, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But he was smart because he actually put him through graduate school, and then and he met my mom in New York.
So how is it that Robert gets the French horn and you don't, David?
I play the bassoon, actually.
Really?
Yeah. And
is there a bassoon rebellion in the works?
Here's the problem with playing the bassoon in general in orchestra and band growing up in high school is that you're drowned out by all the brass players. So constantly it was like, you guys really don't need me here anyways. I might as well not be here. And, you know, some of my friends can attest to me taking some time off during, well, just because I was not really needed, you know.
He used to fall asleep during orchestra a lot.
Not needed. We are in.
So I was up late making beats. That's why.
Yeah, right.
But we are like gearing up to celebrite the 100th anniversary of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which begins with the most famous bassoon solo of all time.
That's true.
Yeah,
my woodwind quintet's playing that right now, actually.
So do you still, David, play the bassoon?
Only in the privacy of our home.
Uh-huh.
But Robert plays in the UN orchestra.
When I'm off tour, I go down to the UN, and they have a community orchestra that I play in.
Oh, okay.
Just for fun. So.
Well, I mean, in all seriousness, with the French horn, you got to keep your chops up because
Absolutely. It's
a notoriously difficult instrument.
The embouchure has got to be tight.
I mean, that sounds kind of gross, but, you know... Whatever. It's true, though. I mean,
I've heard you when you've been, you know, off the horn for a while. It's not as good.
Well, thankfully, we've been playing every Friday night at Brooklyn Bowl lately. Speaking of Fridays. And so I've been able to keep it up, you know.
Yeah.
So
The other thing, and this is a stereotype, I know, is that the French horn is not a particularly nimble instrument.
No. But, what
but
I
you're
will
playing
say,
dance music. You need an instrument that's going to get around a little bit.
It's true, but I've been pegged this by a group called Genghis Barbie, who's friends of ours, who are an all-female horn quartet. They play like the Thong Song, and they play a lot of like Kiss
they
from
do
a Rose
yeah
on
new
YouTube.
Arrangements of popular songs of all time.
Anyways,
on horns.
Yes, horn
she came out because we have a lot of guests at our show. We call our show the Party Ensemble because what it is, it's like a chamber ensemble, but instead of playing, you know, classical music, we're playing dance music. So that's why we got everybody around. This is the Party Ensemble. And so sometimes we have guests, including Genghis Barbie. And they came, and they were like, oh, my gosh, you play the horn the loudest I've ever heard it played. That does not sound good. And I'm like, yep, that's right.
That's what happens when you're battling with the beats. You got to be brass. You got to be
mm-hmm. – you got to have it
gotta
all.
Got to cut through.
And for folks who will be watching the video on our website at soundcheck.org, do the shirts operate on battery, or how does that happen?
A friend of ours, Amber, made these. She sewed in EL wire into the jacket, and it's operated by a battery pack in our pocket.
All right. Look sharp.
She was ecstatic to do it, to try it.
She's always wanted to do this.
She always wanted to do it. So.
All right. Can you wash them?
Well, don't get too close. You might smell some stuff there. Yeah, thankfully over video. We got video and audio, but no...
That was one question too many, obviously. the band is French Horn Rebellion. Their latest EP, a collaboration with the electronic artist Viceroy, is called Friday Nights. It's out now. They're playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio. So who writes the songs, and how do you write around an instrument like the French horn?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm actually a composition theory major in school. Robert did French horn before, and I went to NYU. So I think it's a collaborative process. But I think for French horn rebellion, Robert generally starts with the nuggets for the.
I start the beats.
Yeah,
I'm the beat man.
All right, the French horn player is the beat master.
Yes.
Well, he has to be. It's his rebellion. You know? Right. I'm just helping him out.
All right. Robert and David Perlick Molinari here with the band French Horn Rebellion. You guys want to play another song for us?
Love to.
Let's do it. Speaking of Friday.
Speaking of Friday, this one is called Friday Nights. And once again, the light show and the dancing about to resume here in the Soundcheck studio as the band French Horn Rebellion plays Friday Nights live.
I gotta pull out. Pull it out.
What? What are you pulling out?
Shovel.
Once again, French Horn Rebellion, live on Soundcheck with their song Friday Nights. And that's the name of their latest EP, a collaboration with Viceroy, out now. And guys, you've collaborated, obviously, with Viceroy and lots of other people. Is there a producer out there that you guys are just itching to work with?
That's a good question. I wonder, there's so many people we want to work with, you know, and I think anybody that has the same kind of attitude as us, you mm-hmm. know, where it's inclusive. So it's something where anybody can come. Like, if you're feeling something, let's do it. Let's join. Let's start the rebellion together. You know, that type of thing. Like, we can all play French horn, you know, and that's the way.
No, we can't.
Well, but we, you know.
Theoretically.
Well, the idea is like Jody Watley, for example, is such a dream person to work with on vocals. And she's singing on actually our next single, which is coming out in about a month.
Okay.
And she is like our flute player, you know. She's kind of like in our orchestra. She's part of our party ensemble as well. And so everybody that comes along is part of the group, you know.
Mm-hmm. Play their part.
So this is part of the rebellion, is that these instruments that have been typecast as orchestral instruments can get out on a Friday night and party as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And we can all be part of the orchestra. You know, it's not an exclusive thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's for everybody.
The band is French Horn Rebellion, and guys, it's been a little party here in the studio. Thanks so much for bringing all the sound and light and movement and music to our Soundcheck studio today.
Our pleasure.
You can listen to even more music from French Horn Rebellion at our website, soundcheck.org, where you will find a video of the band performing in their full neon glory. That's going to do it for the show today. Tomorrow on Soundcheck, Louder Than Hell bills itself as the definitive oral history of metal and boasts 250 interviews with key players. Editors John Wiederhorn and Catherine Turman talk about a project 25 years in the making. Actor and longtime musician Creed Bratton plays the character of Creed Bratton on NBC's The Office. Before the show airs its series finale on Thursday, we ask Creed to weigh in on the popular 90s rock band Creed. You won't want to miss that. And British soul singer Alice Russell joins us to perform songs from her new record, To Dust. All of that tomorrow. See you then. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.